Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 278, and we're going to discuss a particular article I came across from KIRO Channel 7, because they've announced that van life is canceled. We're also going to talk about a new battery that's available from Blue Yeti that could be a game changer, and a discussion of why a 5-volt circuit makes sense in your van. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Thanks for joining me once again. It has been a very busy time here. I've had a lot of medical stuff lately, and I'm frankly sick of it. But I am deep in the process of planning and building out my next rig, which fills me with joy. I have to say, I absolutely love this pod thing that I've got. I'll talk more about that in the Tales from the Road segment, but this thing makes me happy. That's all I'm going to say for now. But I'll tell you something that doesn't make me happy, and it's when the news, the media, decides to say something silly about van life. And Darren Karen, the rhyming duo who has also provided the news for this segment, sent me this one article that I actually changed what I was going to talk about just so I could address it. And this is from KIRO, Seattle's Channel 7. It's a CBS affiliate. And they published this kind of recycled thing, but I have to just share this with you, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, but we're going to talk about it a bit, because it creates this false narrative that's been bugging me for a while. First off, this article is from June, so this was written at kind of the beginning of the spring-summer travel season, and the title of the article is This Why Americans Have Hit the Brakes on the Hashtag Van Life Dream? You may have heard of Bettridge's Law of Headlines. This was coined by journalist Ian Bettridge, and he basically said that if a headline ends with a question mark, the answer is almost always no. And in fact, you should assume it's no from the start. So, is this why Americans have hit the brakes on the hashtag van life dream? I'm going to say no. In fact, I'm going to question the question. Have Americans hit the brakes on the van life dream? Such clever wordplay. So, their story, as they're telling it in this article, is that van life, as we know it, was this pandemic phenomenon where people, you know, couldn't work or whatever, they had to isolate, so they all took to vans and traveled the country. And, you know, there's some truth to that narrative. I'm not dismissing that. But what they're suggesting is that now that the pandemic's over, so is van life. But let's look exactly at what they say. First off, they start with some things have stuck around, and they mention Zoom calls, grocery delivery, and comfy pants. And then they say, but living out of a van freely on the open road, it seems, has not had the same staying power. Really? I am not so sure that's true. And then they do this amazing thing where they lump all recreational vehicles, all camping in vehicles entirely under the van life overarching term. Now, we do that here, right? We're big tents. So when I'm talking about stuff, it can apply to your fifth wheel or your car camper or a tent on the side of the road, whatever. But they're saying that RVing is van life. And I would argue that the people who take the family out twice a year in their pop-up camper aren't really doing what most people think of as van life. As far as the podcast goes, they're more than welcome to join the community. That's not what we're talking about. But to say that is van life leads me to believe that they don't know what van life is. They're citing research conducted by a company called Moto Integrator, who appears to be from France, and another organization called Data Pulse Research. And, you know, they probably did a survey, but they also looked at the numbers. And what are the numbers they looked at to determine the death of van life? Well, they looked at RV sales. And sure, RV sales boomed during the pandemic years and immediately following. In fact, the highest year for RV sales was 2021, which was right at the height of the pandemic. That isn't surprising. And then what happened in 2023? Levels plummeted. They dropped below 2015 values, which of course they did. Everybody who was going to buy an RV had already bought one. This isn't something folks buy every year, you know? You figure they're going to wait a few years before they get another one. They also charted camping trends. And what's interesting is that in 2017, buying went up, but the trend in camping didn't follow suit. They actually broke in 2018, where in 2018, interest in camping went way up through 2019 and through 2020 at the same rate. But buying campers, buying RVs, went down. That shows there's a disconnect between the number of people camping and the number of people buying RVs. In fact, if you ignore the number of RV shipments, people have been camping more since 2017, slight uptick in 2018, steady uptick in 2019, 2020, and 21. The same exact curve. Still an increase into 2022, but then it levels off. And then in 2023 and 2024, the numbers drop quite a bit and basically end up where they were at the start of 2018. RV sales don't follow that same pattern. I mean, generally they do from a 10,000 foot view, they do, but not entirely, because RV shipments in 2023 were way below the average in 2015, but camping remained way higher. The narrative they could have spun here is that though RV sales are down, camping remains popular, but that's not what they chose to do. They chose to say Americans have hit the brakes on the van life dream. Now, the people doing the research did admit that the pandemic was a massive disruption. Of course it was. You had low production and you had high demand. That's a disruption. Prices went way up too. And then they finally admit, this is not to say van life is completely gone. But here's my biggest problem with this. They haven't talked about van life. They've talked about camping and RV sales. And in a way that is not all-encompassing. They don't talk about how many people were living in vans full-time, how many people had converted vans, how many people were spending a night in their van on any given night during the year, etc. And I admit these would be difficult numbers to come up with, but they didn't try. And they're saying, the words they're using make it sound like they do have those numbers somehow, and I don't like that. And then they go back into the history. People living in vans started as a subculture in the 60s. Okay, whatever. We've talked about that in the past. And here's the truth of this. They finally admit way down in the article, these figures do not account for retrofitted vans, which are beloved by the van life community. These vans, often former work vehicles or delivery vans, exploded in popularity thanks to their budget-friendly customization options and flexibility. Unlike larger trailers or bus-like mobile homes, they are easier to drive and park while still being more comfortable than tents. And okay, so you've just admitted that this article has nothing to do with van life. They add a little bit about how in 2021, companies that retrofitted vans had long waits. Sure, companies that retrofit vans are basically RV companies. They had the same demand. But that, to me, is not a huge part of van life. Most van life people I've met didn't buy their van. They built it out themselves or bought somebody else's van that was already built out. There are people who buy a new van and then have somebody build it out. That absolutely happens. I do know one person who did that. Sportsmobile is a company that does that. They do excellent work. But that's not that common. Most van lifers I talk to bought an old van and fixed it up themselves, or bought somebody else's old van that was already fixed up, or bought an old RV. And those numbers are not in this article. Ah! They do mention a good thing, though, and we talked about this a lot, is that during the pandemic, delivery companies need a lot of vans, and Amazon bought every van on the planet, and it was actually hard to find vans. We definitely talked about that. So, okay, fine. They're not being completely dishonest. But then they say, the end of the dream, and I will read this part verbatim. Nonetheless, many Americans did succeed in landing their own recreational vehicle. The race to get or retrofit RVs created an influx of newbie owners, as shown by the chart below. More than half, 55% of today's RV owners are newbies who have owned their vehicle for just 5 years or less. 5 years or less? That makes you a newbie? I mean, this podcast is a little over 5 years old, so hey, I have graduated. I'm no longer a newbie, apparently, which, you know, is silly. I'll tell you what, I get to define this just like they do, right? You are a newbie if you're in your first month of van life. After that, after a month of living on the road, you've got experience. You are an experienced van lifer. You don't have as much experience as someone who's done it for years, but in a month, you've encountered your share of trouble, and you've overcome it if you're still in the van after a month. And I'm sorry, that experience counts for something. You are not a newbie. I kind of wonder if this was an AI-written article, because some of the text is just so cliched. The van life movement appears to have deflated as quickly as it ballooned in pandemic-era America. It turned out to be a detour, not a destination. As a result, many vehicles bought during the pandemic are not racking up much mileage today. But you're basing it on the wrong numbers. Ugh. They're saying 10 million households in the U.S., 8% about, camped in an RV last year. And 8 million of those were RV owners, so they're accounting for 2 million renters. That seems like it might be a lot, the article says, but it's down from 15 million, nearly 12% of households, that camped in an RV at the 2022 peak. Folks had more time then. There were a lot of people working from home that now have to be back in the office because companies feel like you need to be in an office for some reason. And then weirdly, they say that the problem is there aren't enough newbies. In 2022, there were a lot of new people, and now, well, there just aren't as many new people. Well, the people who camped in 2022 aren't new people anymore, except that you think that they are because they don't really go over their methodology here. I mean, they do cite it, but I tried to look and see where they were getting the data. And really, all this is doing is tracking that there was a surge of RV sales and RV camping during the pandemic, and that's it. So my question is, why don't they say that? Why do they have to attach this to van life or the hashtag van life? And I think the reason is that van life was much more of a cultural phenomenon than RVing is. Van life is cooler. Van life got attention. And while you and I know that van life didn't go anywhere, there's still plenty of people doing it out there. Plenty of people. For the media, it's kind of a passé issue. And now they're going, oh, that van life thing. Oh, those silly people. They've come to their senses now and they're not doing this anymore. And you can just look at these RV numbers and see that when it isn't true. And in fact, given everything that's going on in the country this year, I expect a major upswing in van life with quotes, but it isn't going to be the van life that they're talking about because we're not talking about RVs. We're talking about people who are living in their vans and their cars because they have to. That, I believe, is going to be on a huge upswing this year, especially if the government stays shut down much longer. But yeah, you've heard enough about that. So folks, This is major media here. It's a CBS affiliate, and this is what they're publishing. And it's really low quality and misleading. And if you were not in the van life community, you might read this article and say, oh, that van life thing's gone. I'm not going to do that. Of course, that means nothing. If you want to live in your vehicle, it's just as possible now as it ever was. There are some new challenges, absolutely. I've talked about them a lot. But the van life dream is not dead. It never will be dead. And it has existed as long as people have had vehicles that they could live in. Sailing, this dream of sailing around the world in a sailboat, is the same dream as van life. It's just water van life. Or if you prefer, we're doing dirt sailing. I don't care. Very similar thing. So folks, Don't worry about all these reports about the death of van life or anything like that. Almost all the media we see now is driven by what will people pay attention to. It's inflammatory, it's clickbait, and this article was really just that. And as I can see, they have zero comments on this article. I'm probably giving it more attention than it needs to. You can blame Darren Karen for that. No, seriously. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate you sending me this story. And yeah, I am still very, very, very much pro van life. I think van life is continuing to be the phenomenon it always has been. And I'm not going to let any of this crap dissuade me. A special thanks to Alex and everybody else who has bought me gallons of whatever you'd like at buymeacoffee.com/built2go. That's two T's, not three, not one, because of you folks and especially those who donate every month. There are no ads on this podcast, and that makes it a very nice place to be indeed. Thank you, everyone. If you would like to help support the podcast, please visit buymeacoffee.com/built2go, and you can buy me a gallon of whatever you would like. Thank you. Van Life News. Again, this is all from Darren Karen. They are doing me a real favor by giving me news articles, because that is honestly my least favorite thing to research. I'm so sick of the news that I hate wading through it all. So every once in a while, they'll send me a bunch of news, and I'm very happy to share it with you. So, first thing is good news. This is good news, and this is actually very exciting. So we're all familiar with Blue Yeti, or most of us are. Blue Yeti's a company that makes these all-in-one batteries, sometimes called solar generators, even though they are neither solar nor a generator. But they're very common. You know, they're comparable to Jackeries or Goal Zeros, and there's a whole bunch of different brands that make these. But Blue Yeti has really tried to innovate a bit. And now they've innovated something that's only been talked about. And I think I linked a news article about this a couple years ago. But they have started making batteries that aren't lithium iron phosphate. They're using a new chemistry that involves salt. It is a sodium ion portable power station called the Pioneer NA. NA is the chemical symbol for sodium. And in the article I have linked in the show notes, it says that they'll be available around mid-October of this year, and in fact, they are. You can find these on the Blue Yeti site now, and there's actually a huge sale. They're $500 off, which seems to be almost always the case now with these batteries. Why would you want one of these batteries instead of lithium iron phosphate? And the answer is, they have similar characteristics to lithium iron phosphate. Does 4,000 charge cycles, and, you know, some lithium iron phosphate advertises 10,000 charge cycles. 4,000 is pretty good. And it is a little bit heavier than lithium iron phosphate, 20 to 25% heavier. But it has the same discharge capacity. You can get down below 80%. And it doesn't use a lot of the nasty chemicals that are important for lithium iron phosphate. So those are some good things. But the main thing, the most exciting thing about this, and why I think this could be a game changer, especially for those up north, is that this chemistry you can charge below freezing. So no more battery heaters, no more your BMS shutting down or anything like that. This will charge down to negative 15 C and keep discharging down to negative 25 C. Or for you Fahrenheit folks, 5 degrees Fahrenheit, it'll still take a charge. And negative 13 degrees Fahrenheit, you can still use it. So that's awesome. That means that you could use solar panels during most winter days. Yeah, okay, I know the sun's not up as much in the northern hemisphere. I get it. But you could use it during the day when the temperature's above 5 Fahrenheit or negative 15 C. And then if it goes below that at night, that's okay. You can still use the batteries. You couldn't charge them then anyway. And that's, of course, the temperature outside. If the battery's in your van and you're in the van with it, you're not going to be in your van at negative 25 C. I promise you're going to warm it up. Anyway, these are very cool, and the pricing is pretty similar to LiFePO batteries. So I'm excited about this. There are many reasons why lithium iron phosphate batteries need to be replaced by something else. I love them. I think they're the number one choice right now for batteries. But this, if these catch on, they could be a very, very good thing for us all. So that's a link worth checking out. I have the original news article from Interesting Engineering. And then if you want to actually see the price and buy them, you can go to blueyeti.com. So that's awesome. Next news article. This is also good news. However, if you're in the U.S., we have the same old problem. But Kia, the Korean manufacturer, has a new electric van. It's called the Kia PV5. And it's actually one of these cool, kind of futuristic space-looking vans. But it's a full-size van. It's not as big as the biggest, like, e-transits or anything like that. But it's bigger than a minivan. And it looks pretty cool. I kind of like it. It's the size of van that we actually want that we can't find. It's using the same tech as a lot of other Hyundai Kia products. It's 184.8 inches long, 75 inches wide, and 75 inches tall. It's 120-inch wheelbase, so, you know, smaller than a Sprinter van. But you can park it in a normal parking space. And on the inside, it's got a lot of space. This would make a very, very nice camping platform. The front looks very much like any car, so it's not all that strange. And then it comes with a bunch of different battery packs, which is, of course, the limit in these things. So the small battery pack is 51.5 kilowatt hours. Or you can go up to 71.2 kilowatt hours, which is definitely the one that you should get. And that gives you about 250 miles, which is optimistic. In the U.S., you'd probably get 230 miles, which is comparable to a Volkswagen ID. Buzz. And this is a comparable van, although this one has a pure cargo version that would be better for conversion to van life. And it's front-wheel drive, so it's got that going like the ProMasters do, which has pros and cons, which we've talked about in the past. But front-wheel drive is good for van life because you don't have a drive shaft and stuff between the wheels. It's much easier to mount things to the bottom, or if you have to drill holes to let pipes go through and stuff, you have a lot less stuff in the way with a front-wheel drive vehicle. It uses the 400-volt electrical architecture, and the more expensive ones have an 800-volt setup, and they charge a lot more quickly. But it's they claim, this is, you know, these are all claims here. I haven't put my hands on one of these things. They can go from 10 to 80% in 30 minutes on a DC fast charger, which is pretty cool. So, if we lived in the world we deserve, these things would be available, and people would be making camper vans out of them. They are supposedly coming to Canada, but again, we live in a world where trade is weird. And here's the part that I think is super exciting. They're going to start at about $30,000, $30,000, which is about $20,000 cheaper than the base Volkswagen. So, cheap electric van, capable enough to do van life. Kia is working on it, and I don't know that we'll ever see it in the U.S., but other folks, this apparently is on the way. It's the PV5. Again, I'll have a link in the show notes. Now, there's another van that we probably will not be seeing in the U.S. It's a Mercedes. And if you've ever been to Hong Kong or some other Asian countries and you've used an Uber, it may have shown up, and it's a van, and you recognize the van, but when you get inside, it's like all tricked out with reclining seats and crazy stuff in it. And Mercedes has decided that it's time to bring that kind of van to the United States. And this is sort of Metris size. It's a medium-sized van. They call it a V-Class, which in Europe you would call the Vitaro. It's actually being called the Mercedes-Benz VLE and VLS class. And it's a super luxurious van, almost like the conversion vans that were so popular in the 70s and 80s in the United States. Very futuristic, comfy seats, a bar, video games. I mean, just all kinds of stuff tossed in there. And I don't see these having a lot of van life potential, actually. It's got an enormous TV screen that basically takes up the entire inside of the van. Between you and the driver, the whole wall is a TV screen. And that's really all they say. You know, all the marketing for this is how cool it is. They don't mention price. They don't mention how far it's going. But I'm pretty sure these are going to be over $100,000. And I don't know. Interesting van. Another van. Unusual in that they're announcing it'll come to the U.S. So somehow they're going to get around the chicken tax. But I don't think that's going to be a camper van, at least not for 10 years or so. Someone might find old ones and then turn them into campers, because you can turn anything into a camper. And one last news article I'm not going to mention very much. BrightDrop, the electric van from General Motors that was going to be the future of everything, well, they're not going to make them in Canada anymore. They're not even going to have them in Canada anymore. So that's kind of a downside. Just a couple years ago, it seemed like electric vans were going to be the thing. Everybody was doing that, and well, the world changed. And now a lot of these auto manufacturers are left in this position like, well, what do we do? We were all changing over to this electric stuff, and now there's pushback, and we don't really have models that we can make that are gasoline-powered anymore. I mean, the Transit's not going anywhere, but what has General Motors got? They've got their aging van platform they've had for decades, and apparently they're just going to keep making more and more of those until the world settles down and we know where we are. Interesting times, the Chinese curse says. Tech Talk. Why a 5-volt circuit makes sense. So I'm in the middle of building out a new rig, so, you know, I've done this before. This isn't new to me. But stuff has changed since I did my first and even second one. And my first rig, I was of the opinion, everything's got to be 12 volts. Everything's got to be 12 volts. 12 volts is the most efficient. I will get the most power, the most bang for the buck. It's all going to be 12 volts. And I did. In fact, my first van, the entire back of the van ran off of one cigarette lighter plug, and I could move it. I could plug it into the batteries I had installed, I could plug it into a power station, or I could plug it into the starter battery circuit if I needed to. That was super convenient, but I'm only getting 10 amps out of that cord, so I limited my whole rig to 10 amps. But that was fine. I was able to do that in that little tiny van. That was all I needed. I had lights, fan, refrigerator, and that was about it. I could fit all that in 10 amps. Now, I want more stuff. I've become accustomed to having a microwave in the van, so I'm trying to put that in there. It takes up a lot of space, uses a lot of power, but I really like having it. It makes things take a lot less time. And I want to play around with air conditioning. I bought an EcoFlow air conditioner that I haven't tried yet due to the calamity of my Sprinter last year. And I'm seeing more and more USB stuff, and it does what I want. Now, USB stuff is 5 volts. Again, USB was never meant to power things. That was Apple that came up with that with the iPhone and said, hey, what if we could charge our phones off the USB? USB was just meant to send data, and it had a little tiny bit of power. Well, that idea has caught on so much that now you can get quite a bit of power out of USB. But what if in your van, you built a USB circuit around the van? And I think I'm going to do that. And this is why. I have a bunch of fans now that run on USB power and also charge on USB power. And I've seen more and more lights that run on USB power that are very bright and perfect for a small space like in a van. And they tend to be very flexible. You can get them in configurations. Like right next to me now, I have this desk lamp that I can aim anywhere I want. It's super bright and it only draws 5 volts. It's running off of an old iPhone charger right now. And in my pod that I'm building, I am actually going to do this. I am going to have a beefy 5-volt power adapter running off of either 12 volts or 110 volts. I haven't figured that out yet, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But I'm going to run it around in a loop, and I'm going to be able to attach things to it that I need. And I think most of my fans and lights are actually going to run off of 5 volts. It's very low power, very low heat, and I really like the options you can get. For example, there are times where I need the lights in my rig to be red because I'm going to dark sky sites where people are trying to look at stars, and even the smallest bit of white light will really annoy people. It's super easy and cheap to buy 5-volt LED lights that can be made red. It's like under $10 to light the entire van on USB. And the wiring is also tiny. It's trivial. And then you can plug it into anything that'll give you USB power, such as the Jackery that I'm using initially to power my van. I've got a Jackery 1500 right now. I said van, I mean pod. I've got that right now, and that's powering the whole thing. And I'm going to not have solar until the winter's over, because I'm going to be building this during the winter. And then in the spring, I will add solar. So in between, I'm going to use this Jackery 1500, and that's going to power the entire van, because I can charge that indoors easily. I can bring the battery in at night, so I don't have to worry about freezing. And I can also charge off of the starter battery while I'm driving. So that's what I'm doing for flexibility. But it also has USB ports that come right out of it. And I think I'm just going to get a USB splitter plug it in there, and then run a whole bunch of 5-volt USB cable around, and that'll take care of lights and fans. I don't see a reason not to. If you can think of one, let me know. But low power, high efficiency, that's what van life's about. So think about it. If you're doing a small rig, especially a no build, you don't have to use 12 volt. You can use 5 volt. And then in an emergency, you can power all that stuff by a little battery pack that you might use to charge your phone with. It's just so flexible. And if any of those 5-volt USB things have their own batteries, like the stroller fans that I've become so enamored with, well, if something happens and you run out of power, you can keep using them. I don't know. I think it's a good idea. I haven't heard of anybody doing this, but I'm going to give it a try, and I will report back as to how well it works or doesn't work. In my case, if it doesn't work, big deal. I'll replace it with 12 volts. But I think it makes a lot of sense to have a 5-volt circuit in the van, and it frees up space for 12 volts, too, for more high-power stuff. Product review. This week, we're trying something new here. Chris, from Kent in the UK, as he'll announce himself, has done a lovely review of a Blue Eddy product, and I'm going to just give you his review. And he's helping me out by doing a portion of the podcast, and I hope he had fun doing it, and I hope you have fun listening to him. He has some very good information.
Hi, my name's Chris from Kent in the UK. Today I'm going to review the Blue Eddy Apex 300, also the Hub D1 and Charger 1, but I'll get onto that in a minute. I have a 2010 Sprinter, and that used to be a minibus, and I've taken nearly all the seats out, just kept two in for the kids and the two front seats that were in it when I got it. And it is a bit of a work in progress. I treat it as an ongoing experiment. So I'm not really aiming for it ever to be completed, but I'm trying different things at different times and seeing how I could improve it. So far, or up until very recently, I've relied on one of the old Jackery 500s for electrics. And I've actually even got a small induction hob, which I use to cook on that. And with a 200 watt portable solar panel, if it's a sunny day, I can usually get enough power to be able to cook. But also up until recently, I haven't had a heater in here. Last winter, it got very cold. I'm a sort of one night a week van lifer, so I tend to go on a Wednesday night and have my night away, but that was really cold last year, and I thought, if I'm going to carry on doing this through the winter, which I really love doing, I thought I am next year going to get a heater. So I have just got a heater, but my electrical experience and knowledge is not brilliant. I did do physics at school, but I have a sort of basic understanding, but I find the kind of electrical systems that you see on a lot of YouTube videos and in the back of people's vans pretty intimidating. And I think, yeah, I'm not going to be able to do that. And also the other thing is, my van is a Sprinter, which I know has mixed reviews on this podcast, and it's 2010, so it's not a new vehicle. Every time I go to the garage, I have the kind of fear of what's it going to be, how much is it going to be this time, and I can do a bit of the mechanical stuff myself, but most of it I can't. So I sort of live in fear of a catastrophic failure, and so I'm hesitant to spend too much time or too much money on fitting out when maybe it's not going to last. Because it was a minibus, it was already lined in the back, so I haven't put insulation in. And I mean, I haven't been through a winter yet with my diesel heater, so I can't really say. But so far, I think it's going to be fine, actually, without insulation. It's not especially cold in the UK, and I'm in the south, so I'm hopeful. But the problem with diesel heaters is they draw a bit too much power for like a Jackery 500. It can do it, but because the only 12 volt outlet is the cigarette lighter, and they tend to be rated at 10 amps as a maximum, basically a lot of them just won't power the startup cycle on a diesel heater. Actually, my Jackery 500 will just, but I certainly wouldn't be able to do that and run my 12 volt fridge and have some lights. So yeah, that would be too much. So for ages, I've been looking at the solar generators, as I know Jeff is keen to have them called, and trying to find one with a more than 10 amp outlet. And every now and then, like, one pops up and then gets discontinued. But just recently, the Bluetti Apex has come onto the market. You have to buy an extra bit called the Hub D1. But with that Hub D1, it actually has a 50-watt Anderson connector. And so I looked at that. It is expensive. So it's an expensive unit. For the hub and the unit itself, it is £2,000, which I don't quite know what the exchange rate is, but I guess that's $2,500. But most things seem to be cheaper in the US anyway. I don't know what it is in the US. But yeah, it's £2,000 here for the Apex 300, for the hub, which is how you can get out the 50 amps of 12 volts, and for a charger. And that's the other sort of missing piece of the puzzle for me is, well, if I have a big power station or a big battery, how am I going to get it charged? And I know that there are chargers, one of those blue Victron things that, or other brands are available, things that people have, but I found it a bit frightening, the how do you connect all this stuff up kind of part. So it was a bit reassuring to me that the Apex 300 essentially has one which is recommended to work with it, and which they said was very easy to fit. That is actually what I've done, is I've bought the Apex 300, the hub, and the charger. And I've had it a couple of months now, and I have to say I love it. I think it works really well. It was easy to install. It's just worked flawlessly. It's about, I think it's 2.7 kilowatt hours of power, so almost six times my Jackery 500. And yeah, I've not run out or anything like. When I'm driving, it just charges at about 550 watts, and the alternator doesn't seem to mind at all. And that charges it up pretty quick. So I guess it would be about 5 hours from if it was completely empty. Often I just drive for an hour, but that gives me plenty of power. And I haven't actually rigged up any solar. I probably will at some point, but at the moment I haven't bothered because that gives me what I need. And it includes four AC power outlets. I only ever use one or two, but I have one for my induction hob, and then one for sometimes I plug my laptop in, sometimes I plug a dehumidifier in. I don't have a ceiling fan, so when I get home, I usually, in the winter, I put on a dehumidifier and make sure everything gets fully dried out. It just works flawlessly. You have to plug in this hub to get the 12-volt outlets. The standard unit doesn't have any 12-volt outlets. I don't even think it has. It doesn't even have a USB outlet. But you plug in this hub into the side of it, and that gives you two cigarette lighter outputs, which actually I haven't used yet, two USB-C, which are both 100 watts. So actually, I can just plug my laptop into that, two USB-A, and this 50 amp Anderson outlet, which I'm now plugging into all the other stuff in my van, which I say all the other stuff, that's the diesel heater, the fridge, and then I just have some USB-A outlets that were actually left over from its time as a minibus. So that works really well, and so I just plug lights and phone chargers and stuff into those wherever I need them. So I am a really satisfied customer for the Bluetti. I've not had a Bluetti thing before. I've had a couple of Jackeries, the 240, this really little one, and then the 500. So one thing I was really interested in is how long it would last with the inverter turned on. It'll last a few days with the inverter turned on, and it will last about 10 days with the DC turned on, which is loads. And you can set in the settings that if you want it to turn itself off, if there's no draw on it, it can do that, or you can set it so that it doesn't do that. I turned my fridge off at night, and then I wondered why the DC had gone off overnight. That's it. And now I realise that that setting was flicked in my app. But it was very easy to switch that. It is quite heavy. It's quite big. It's a bit smaller than a 12-volt fridge. Maybe it's like almost 2 foot long, and then a foot by a foot wide and tall, something like that. It just fits under my bed, so that works quite well. And then I can get to the plugs and sockets on the front and the switches. Yeah, it's heavy enough that you think more than twice about lifting it. You don't want to move it around very much. It's pretty heavy. So it's nice if you can just put it in one place and leave it there. But yeah, it works really nicely. And it does mean that if the engine warning light comes on, I'm just a bit less fearful that, oh no, that means all that hard work is, well, maybe not lost, but certainly would have to be removed and replaced and put in another vehicle. Whereas this way, it almost is plug and play. Oh, I should say about the charger, it was super easy to install the charger. It comes with one of those little trip switches, which you put in the live, and luckily there were a couple of places on the 12-volt battery, and in the Sprinter, the 12-volt battery is under the passenger footwell. So there was space in there actually just to clamp in a couple of new wires. And then I just ran it back to where the battery is. And it comes even with a little screwdriver to screw in the wires. So it literally was about, well, probably took me an hour because of the fiddling around with where the wires go. But it was really straightforward. I was really impressed by that. And that charger will work with other batteries too. If you need to downrate it for a different sort of power station, it was able to do that. So you can get the kind of optimum charging and the optimum charging voltage as well. Because I think it charges at 52 volts when it's charging this one, which is what it's designed for. I hope that's been helpful. I am very pleased with Bluetti, and yeah, I don't have one of those special links which gives me magic money, sadly. But maybe Jeff does, so that would be good too. All right, thank you, and thanks for listening.
Thank you very much for that information, Chris. It sounds like an excellent setup you have here. Some update on the U.S. pricing. Not to upset you, Chris, but in the U.S., that unit is only $1,400 on Amazon right now, and it's $2,400 if you want to add on the expansion pack, which doubles your capacity. And the HubD one is $340 right now. I'll have links in the show note for those if anybody's interested. But Chris, thank you so much for reviewing that product. If you'd like to submit a segment for Built to Go, please do so. You can get a hold of me at jeff@builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And as Chris mentioned, those magic links, a.k.a. affiliate links, if you review a product on this podcast, you can use your own affiliate link and you will get any monetary credit that comes from that. That is my thank you for giving a little bit of the podcast. Otherwise, I'm going to take that credit because I always have the magic links. So thanks again, Chris. And thanks to anyone who's considering doing the same. Tales from the Road. In case you haven't been listening all along, for $500, I bought this 8-foot long, 5-foot high, fiberglass utility body that fits in the back of my 8-foot pickup truck. This is not a shell that fits on the rails. This is a solid piece with a floor that can be removed in its entirety and put on, and it's a standalone unit made of fiberglass. Spacecap is the most common company that makes them now. Mine happens to be a cargo body company, but they're long out of business. It doesn't matter. All right, imagine this. If you've ever seen a Scamp trailer, I've talked about them. Imagine a Scamp that had no wheels. That's sort of what I've got here. It's not as tall. I can't stand up in it, but it's over 6 feet wide and 8 feet long. And the height inside is 54 inches or so. And wow, I love it in there. I go out there, and even though it's not built out yet, I just sit there and imagine myself in here. And what I did was, taking a hint from Luke in Finland, I didn't do what I normally recommend, which is create a bedroom and then make everything else work. I created a workspace, and I'm going to make everything else work. I created a desk system, and I actually bought an office chair. The first thing I bought, okay, back up. I had a fire extinguisher, and I had a smoke detector and a CO detector. Those were already stuff I had, but I bought an office chair. I found an office chair I liked on Amazon, and it was one that the back folded over so I could push it under something. That was the very first thing I bought, and I put it in there, and it's glorious. I feel like I have my own little command center now. And I figured out how I'm doing the desk and the bed, and they're integrated. So at the front of the pod, there will be a desk. So when I'm sitting there in the chair, I'm facing forward, and there is a desk that's 6 feet long, and it's going to be 18 inches deep. That's a ton of space. On the left, there is a 16-inch shelf that runs the entire 8 feet. That's great. Where am I going to sleep, though? Well, on top of the shelf on the left that goes all that way, there is a 12-inch piece of wood that folds over. 12 plus 16 is 28. That is about an inch bigger than my sleeping pad, which is 27, and I've got a bed. I just flip the shelf over, and I've got a bed there. And my desk doesn't have to move. Like, if I have a laptop set up, I can just leave it there. I just have to slide it over a bit. My pillow ends up being on the left-hand portion of the desk. It's going to work great. And I have all that space underneath. And because this came with shelves that were on the side, I was able to remove some, and my entire bed system actually sits on like a hidden compartment. So not only can I flip down the flap to make it wider, I can flip the whole thing up, and I have all this hidden storage where I can put things that are like 4 inches deep and a foot across. That's about how much size I have. But that's 6 feet long. There's a lot of things, you know, hoses, utensils, any kind of papers, whatever. I can put all that in there. On the other side, I have the shelving that was originally there. And it's this heavy-duty steel shelving that I can move the shelves on and put dividers in. And the microwave oven fit right in there. And there's all these places to put food. This is all gonna work perfect. I'm gonna still have some challenges with the sink. What I think I'm going to do is get a very high-quality paint tray. You know, the things that when you're rolling paint on, you put the paint in this and then you put the roller in there. That's exactly the shape that will fit on the lowest shelf of the shelving. And I just drill a hole in it and there's the drain. And then the water can come from above and I can figure that out. I can use my USB pump or do something else. That's going to be fairly easy. I might just have a sprayer, actually. That's what I'm thinking. I will just have a sprayer. And that's not going to take up that much space. And as Liz pointed out long ago, the point of a sink isn't to have a basin. It's to have a drain. If I need a big bowl of water for some reason, I'll bring a bowl and I'll fill that up with water. And then when I'm done with it, I will dump it down this drain. The sloping part of the paint tray is a good place to put a coffee cup so it'll drain out, you know, that kind of thing. I think that's going to work, and it's going to cost me like $10. I will let you know. It's a little bit of a crazy idea, but heck, my first van, I made the sink out of a dog bowl, and that worked just fine. So I'm confident this is going to be okay. The fridge is just going to fit in there at the back, and it's going to be removable. So if I'm out camping, I can take it out and put it on the ground. Or if I need a drink, I can just open the door and grab a drink or whatever. The toilet is going to be my tall cassette toilet that I have a cover on, and that's going to act as a stool and a footstool and whatever. That thing has worked out great. I reviewed it a long time ago now, but it was a Kori. It was the tall Kori with the 5 gallon tank. That works. And I know some people really don't like cassette toilets, but I have to say that just works fine. And it's nice to have that space to sit down and put your shoes on or whatever. So that's going to work perfectly. For heat, currently, I'm using my Olympian Wave 3, which means I need to have a propane tank. I am not using those green cans. Those things are a pain in the butt. I have a full-size propane tank in there. But that's a risk, right? You don't want to have the propane tank in your living area. You want it to be in a locker that you can drain. And I haven't really built one of those yet, and I'm not sure I'm going to. Instead, what I got was a propane tank bag, and the propane tank is in there. And I intend to modify that so that there are no holes in it, and there's a drain out the bottom. That way, if there's any propane leaks in there, it's almost like a portable locker. Not ideal, but better than just having the propane tank in there. And it also keeps the thing secure, so it's not going to run around. And the bonus of this is that on both sides of the pod, the entire sides lift up. So if I go grocery shopping or whatever, I can just lift that up and put the items out of the shopping cart right into the shelves of the van immediately. This is going to be so great. Now, this is great for me, right? This is basically going to be a one-person deal here. If my wife decides she wants to come with me, she's either going to sleep in the truck across the seats because she's tiny, or she probably I will sleep on the floor of the pod on a pad, and she can have the actual bed above it. We'll figure it out. But it's not designed for two people. If we're going to do serious camping with two people, we've got the truck camper and also the Airstream. So that's covered. The big thing that I'm really excited about here, other than how comfortable it is in this thing, is that it's removable. For somebody who has a truck, and you need to use it as a truck, but you also want it to be a camper, and you have to park in the city, this is ideal. I can take it off and put it on in a matter of 10 minutes, and I have my truck back. Or I can put the truck camper on there. Or I can put this thing on a trailer. I could even put the truck camper on the truck and then tow this behind it as kind of like an in-law apartment or something. Anyway, I love this thing. It was only $500, and it's something that I wish people would do more of. I see that there's some signs that this is catching on with the foam ones. The company was originally called Tusca, I think, and now they're called, I think, Liberty Campers or Freedom Campers or something like that. That's kind of the same idea, although this has a lot more space, and it's much, much lighter than a traditional truck camper because it's not as wide. And it will also really help in gas mileage. So what are the downsides? Well, I currently have no windows and no ventilation, so I have to fix that. I can't see through the back window of the truck through this thing and out of it like I can with the truck camper. That's fixable. I just have to add some windows. The biggest drawback is the jacks. In order to get it out of the truck, I need to install these big custom jacks and lift it up. It takes time, but the biggest problem is those jacks are kind of hard to find. I got very, very lucky and found three of them for $25 that some farmer was getting rid of 100 miles away from where I was. I'm supposed to have four, but I can make it work with three. But the pricing to buy a brand new fourth one is like $400. These things are crazy expensive. So I keep looking out for them. But again, these are a strange style of camper jack. They're not the normal ones. So I have to find just the right one. And if you are doing this, if you're thinking of doing this, make sure you have thought about how you're going to pick this thing up and take it off. Because if it has slots on the side, which a lot of the older ones do, you need the special jacks that I have. If it doesn't, then you can probably do it with either a forklift or a forklift attachment, which is how some of them work. Or you can use the standard, I think they're called Brophy jacks, that have like this right angle piece of angle iron that you attach to the sides and that lifts it up. Those things scare me because you only use two of them and you have to get the center of gravity exactly right. I can play with it a little with mine. This is just what I want and need, and I really feel like I'm back in van life now because I have this thing. The one regret I have is that it's the end of the summer and I'm just getting started on this. I really wish it was the beginning of the summer where I had the temperate days where I could work outside all day. But it's not going to take me long to get the inside set up where I can just do almost everything inside. Big challenge I have is wastewater. I don't know exactly how I'm going to deal with that, but I've always had that problem in all the vans. So pod life, I'm calling this, because it looks like an escape pod. I love the way it looks. This is a great thing. This is so perfect for me, and I'm so excited about it, and I can't wait to hit the road with it. I am 85% sure I'm going to be at Van Fest in Florida now with this rig. I'm going to wait a little bit longer to make sure that my schedule doesn't go crazy, and then I'm going to hit the road and take it down to Florida, and then I've also planned a trip in Vermont in March. I'll have it there too, but yay! I'm very excited about this. After all the trauma and difficulty of last summer, I feel like things are finally going my way a bit in the van life world. A place to visit. I just booked a trip to Hawaii on a very strange ship. It's called Pride of America. It is the only U.S.-flagged ship, and therefore it is the only ship that can sail from Hawaii to Hawaii without going to an international port. This is not a ship I would normally book, but it got me thinking, can you do van life in Hawaii? And if you Google that, you'll find all kinds of talk about people doing van life, and then, oh no, it's illegal to do van life. There are some places in Hawaii where it's illegal to be in your van between the hours of 6 p.m. and 6 a.m., for example. It's an island. There's limited space. Real estate's very expensive. You're going to run into all kinds of problems. But I am here to tell you that you can van life on Hawaii, and the way to do it is to obviously not bring your own van, because that would be outrageously expensive. The way to do it is to visit HawaiiSurfCampers.com. That's the URL. This is a company that rents camper vans in Hawaii, in Honolulu and on Oahu, and you just rent them, and they will tell you where you can go and how you can camp and all that. They take care of all the hassles. And the vehicles that they have, an awful lot of them, are old Volkswagen Westphalias. You know, those really cool pop-up old Volkswagen vans. And remember, you're not going to be doing a lot of interstate driving in Hawaii. This is all going to be slow, scenic driving. So these vehicles are going to be great. They have the old ones that are kind of like the sun buses with all the windows. Then they have the newer, more Euro-looking ones. And they have a few that, you know, there's a Transit here, the 2017 Transit. This would be the way to do van life in Hawaii, in my opinion, unless you were doing something dramatic like moving to Hawaii in your van. That's a whole other thing. Pricing is about $249 per night. And that seems like it might be a lot, but honestly, for Hawaii, that's covering your place to sleep and a place to cook and a place to store your stuff. That's not terrible. Yeah, you might have to pay for some parking, for some campgrounds, and gasoline will be expensive, etc., etc. But what a cool way to see Hawaii. And you can van life in Hawaii. I mean, that's just pretty cool. So check it out. It's HawaiiSurfCampers.com. And honestly, I would rather be doing this than taking the ship. But I have an obligation, and the ship allows me to visit a whole bunch of different islands, which is great. But the pictures on the website, HawaiiSurfCampers.com, make it look really, really cool. Resource recommendation. My Sprinter van is gone. As I said, I was going to donate my van to NPR. And, well, here's what happened. I sold it on Marketplace. I got tons of interest. The guys came, they looked at it, they brought their own Sprinter, which was good, and then they drove off in it, even though I told them that the alternator did not have a belt on it, and they were running off battery power, and they were not going to make it back to Schaumburg, Illinois, where they were headed, about 100 miles away. They seemed to think it was going to be okay. I hope they made it. I don't actually know what happened to them. I waved as they drove off, and I'm guessing they made it back somehow. I guess, worst case, they could have towed it with the other Sprinter. I don't know, but the van is gone, and I am sad about this. I've got all kinds of emotions about it. I always have. But I do want to share something with you about this. And that was the experience I had trying to donate the van to NPR. As I mentioned before, they were giving me problems with it. They were saying they didn't want it, and then they wanted to value it super low. And then finally, they put it up for some kind of pre-donation auction. And they got an offer of $1,100, and they asked if I was willing to accept a receipt for an $1,100 donation for it. And I thought, well, no. I looked around on Facebook Marketplace and on Craigslist and everything, and I was just like, that is crazy. The van is worth more than that. Even if somebody was going to part it out, it's worth far more than that. So my motivation here wasn't to make the most amount of money. My motivation was to get rid of the van. And so I put it up on Marketplace for about double what they were offering me. And in 5 minutes, I had all these people wanting it. And I found the right person, talked to them, made sure they understood the problem. And then, boom, it was gone. Sold. I got my cash. The van is gone. That is the end of the saga of me owning a Sprinter ambulance. I don't know what's going on with these donation companies, but obviously when you donate a van to whomever, and whatever nonprofit, the nonprofit's not doing anything. They've shifted this off to a company that can deal with this. And I've heard some reports that these companies play games where they'll undervalue vehicles so that the amount they give to the nonprofit is actually as low as possible. And then they'll sell it for as much as they can get, or they'll resell it. They'll have a shadow buyer buy it for a low amount or whatever. I don't know that that's what was going on with the company I was dealing with, but the receipts they were offering me were just way, way below market value. And the fact that I sold it in 5 minutes on Marketplace proves that. They could have sold it on Marketplace in 5 minutes too. So I don't know what's going on there, but my advice to you is if you would like to donate your vehicle to a nonprofit, sell it yourself on Marketplace. Yeah, it's a hassle. You deal with a lot of people who are up to something and you're not really sure what. You have to talk to people and all this stuff. You will get more money for it. And if you donate it to NPR or Habitat for Humanity or whatever you want, they will get more money for it too. Heck, you can even split the difference and they'll still get more money for it. So I'm just sharing that experience. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 278. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. And if you need to get a hold of me for any reason, I am Jeff at builttogo.com. That's two T's, not three, not one. I am also on our Discord server and in our Facebook group, and you can find those links at builttogo.com. Until next time, remember the words of Penelope Riley, who said, "It is not the destination where you end up, but the mishaps and memories you create along the way."
Every mile's a memory, every turn's a tale you've told. From the coast to desert sands, you carried all my dreams. Now you're headed to that place where old vans can finally sleep. Your motor's grown so weary, transmission slips and groans, but you still smell like pine trees and the freedom I have known. We drew pictures on your walls, lovers sheltered in the rain. Every dance a chapter in a life, each a joy or pain. This is your last mile, old friend, down this winding country road. Every mile's a memory, every turn's a tale you've told. From the coast to desert sands, you carried all my dreams. Now you're headed to that place where old vans can finally sleep. I'll keep your spirit rolling in every sunset that I see. You taught me home's not just a place, home is being wild and free. Thank you for the miles, old friend, for every road that we have known. Though your journey's ending here, your spirit's found a way back home. Goodbye, my faithful wanderer, rest easy in the shade. But you still smell like pine trees and the freedom I have known. We drew pictures on your walls, lovers sheltered in the rain. Every dance a chapter in a life, each a joy or pain. I'll keep your spirit rolling in every sunset that I see. You taught me home's not just a place, home is being wild and free. Thank you for the miles, old friend.